Hello, I'm Larry Levitt from KFF. Welcome to the latest episode of the Health Wonk Shop. Roughly once a month, we dive into timely and complex health policy topics with experts from a variety of perspectives. While vote counting goes on and on, the picture of what happened in this midterm election is starting to become clearer. But don't put away the popcorn quite yet. With several House races yet to be called, a Senate runoff coming in Georgia, and potential leadership battles in the House. And even as the dust clears from the election results themselves, there are then the questions about what it all means for policy, including healthcare. Inflation was a top issue for many voters, as was abortion, but there's a big difference between what motivated voters and what Congress can actually get done. With a divided Congress, policy gridlock is what immediately comes to mind. We're joined today by two of the smartest people I know when it comes to healthcare policy and congressional politics. Chris Jennings is founder and president of Jennings Policy Strategies. He served in two Democratic White Houses and in key staff positions in Congress. Jennifer Young is a co-founder and partner at Tarplin, Downs & Young. She served in senior positions in HHS during the Bush administration and also as a staffer both in the House and the Senate. If you have questions, submit them at any time through the Q&A button, and we'll get to as many of them as we can. Also note that this session is being recorded and an archived version should be available later today. Jennifer, let me start with you. It's looking likely that Republicans will take control of the House, but with a very narrow margin. The Senate will still be in Democratic hands, and President Biden, of course, is still in the White House. In this environment, what issues do you expect House Republicans to tee up, even if many bills they pass may not actually become laws?
It's such a great question. And I think first, let me start off by saying what they won't be teeing up, and I'm doing a little happy dance as I say this, because for once, repeal and replace isn't the defining backbone of Republican health policy in Congress. It took us years, but I think we have learned that repeal and replace was not a winning issue. And I think there's been an acknowledgement that a Democratic president, turns out, isn't terribly likely to sign repeal and replace into law. So after many, many years, I think there's been a very constructive process in the House, led by the Healthy Future Task Force, which is co-chaired by Brett Guthrie and Vern Buchanan, to think about what kind of a positive, constructive, proactive healthcare agenda looks like that lives in the realm of the doable rather than the hypothetical. And to that end, over the course of the last several months, they've had a really nice process of work groups that included widespread participation from caucus members to try to coalesce around some core themes of security, which relates to pandemic preparedness and supply chains, affordability, which looks at things like transparency and competition, a treatment subcommittee that looks to continue to promote research and development to develop innovative medicines and promote access to American-made medicines, while also thinking about ways to continue to be part of a conversation about lower drug costs. There's been a work group on doctor-patient relationships to encourage the kind of direct partnership between a patient and their clinician, promoting electronic health records, looking at timely access, including reform of prior authorization. And then the final subcommittee has been on modernization to harness technological innovations to deliver affordable care. Now, none of these, unlike the last time there was a Republican contract with America, this is the commitment, not the contract. There's not a timeline expectation that all of this is going to happen in the first 100 days. Instead, these core topics are going to be built out through the committees in regular order through work streams that benefit from the good work that has been done through this process over the course of the last several months. So I think that kind of provides the framework of the sorts of issues that the Republicans will be looking to initiate. I should also say one of the things that continues to be of interest to Republicans is a concern and opposition about the negotiation provision in particular of the IRA that was passed in this current Congress. I do think Republicans understand that a democratically controlled Senate won't take that up, and there, even if they, some miracle would occur there, the president wouldn't sign it. So I don't think that's going to be the sort of legislative exercise that people would expect to spend a lot of time in developing a product that could be signable. But just know that those continued conversations around whether negotiation can impede the continued robust R&D pipelines that we value, whether there's a disconnect there. And then the final thing that I should mention is in a Republican-controlled House, there will be an aggressive approach to oversight. And those oversight efforts will not only be limited to healthcare by any means, but in the healthcare space, pandemic response will certainly be a vibrant part of that oversight agenda. So with that, why don't I pause? I think those are some of the key themes you should expect from House Republicans. And then certainly the Senate Republicans will be looking for ways to reinforce and align with many of those goals through their work in the minority, working in partnership on their committees.
So thanks. We'll definitely want to come back to a number of those issues. Chris, let me turn to you. So on the Senate side, where Democrats have now confirmed that they will be in the majority, just barely, there's the reverse. Democrats control the Senate, but won't necessarily be able to get bills through a Republican-controlled House. And in the Senate, requires 60 votes to overcome a filibuster, so their Democrats may not even be able to pass bills. So what issues do you see Senate Democrats pushing to kind of move their agenda forward?
Well, Larry, it's good to be back with you. I would say, well, first, they reflect back on the election. I think one thing that they saw, and maybe one of the reasons why they're still in the majority, is that the fear of losing protections that people care about, whether it was electoral or whether it's abortion or, frankly, healthcare in general, all those things seem to be bad choices by Republicans. And I think Democrats feel somewhat reaffirmed by both their advocacy of policy and their positioning and to protect those rights. And I think no matter what, that in many ways, it strengthened their resolve to protect those rights and those benefits that they have provided over a period of time. So I want to just acknowledge that straight up. But the Senate, if nothing else, and both Jennifer and I have worked in the Senate, when you're so closely divided, most members really care about pursuing agendas and policies that actually they can see getting at least passed by the Senate, and hopefully even maybe seriously considered in the House and signed into law. It takes the Senate long enough to do almost anything, so you might as well try to do something that could actually get done. And I would say in those categories, we're looking at the leftovers on mental health policies. Opioid treatment programs are very, very big, again, very, very bipartisan. Telehealth and technology, the application of technology are very bipartisan. The committees, both HELP and Finance Committee, are going to be working on those issues. I can see a host of other efforts, for example, lots of interest in transparency, lots of interest in data collection, maybe more state than federal if you're incorporating Republicans, but a lot of interest in empowering purchasers to do better. A lot of concern across both parties about consolidation of marketplaces. And again, I think those are areas where you could see a good bit of attention, bipartisan in the House and the Senate. So in many ways, being able to advance that agenda is important. Now, remember, we had a whole lot of other bigger issues in healthcare that I think some members will continue to be advocating for expansions in the Medicare program, vision, hearing, dental. It's likely that Senator Sanders is going to be chairman of the Senate Health Committee. He may be using that as a platform to highlight some of those issues. I think counter-scheduling, if you will, about what the House does something about oversight that people fear is imbalanced or unfair. You'll see the Senate holding counter oversight entities to both do what they'll say is constructive oversight, but to acknowledge if there are shortcomings that need to be learned, they need to be learned from both administrations, both the Trump and the Biden administration. So I'm just giving you a sampling, Larry, but yes, healthcare, you know, no matter what, for good or for bad, healthcare is a high priority agenda policy. Sometimes we have to lower our expectations about how big and broad. I will say that leftovers from Build Back Better still have big sponsors and promoters in the Senate, and they'll continue to promote those policies. But I think in a Senate that's so split and in a House that's owned by the Republicans, even by just a few votes, I think those the appetite for and success and movement on them will be limited.
You both raised some issues that might have some bipartisan appeal. Talked about mental health, opioids, price transparency, telehealth. Jennifer, let me turn back to you. I mean, it is, we had this rancorous election. The presidential campaign will start almost immediately. What really are the prospects for moving forward bipartisan legislation on healthcare?
I think decent, as long as people's expectations are appropriately set. This is not going to be a Congress in which you can accomplish bold coverage goals in a bipartisan way. But you've alluded to telehealth. I think absolutely there's a strong sense that as this end of the year package moves forward, it will be essentially buying time on telehealth to use the next Congress to think through in a bipartisan way what should the long-term telehealth solutions include. Do there need to be program integrity parameters built in? What worked, what didn't, what should be sustained moving forward? I think that could absolutely be a bipartisan conversation. Chris already mentioned mental health, and I think that's absolutely right. There's strong interests on both sides to take advantage of the good work that has already been done and to pull that through to completion. I would also add, I get a little twitchy mentioning it because I think we all have a little bit of PTSD as it relates to physician payment. But I do think we've reached a point where there's an emerging bipartisan consensus that MACRA, which was the SGR fix, is going to need some fixes of its own as we go into the next Congress. We've seen too many years with CMS finalizing payment rules that include meaningful reductions in physician payment per the MACRA statute that Congress is then not comfortable seeing implemented. And then Congress has to jump in and patch it for the full or for some component of the overall reduction. So that creates that messy cycle of then that just makes the next cuts harder. So I think there is a desire to step back in a bipartisan way and think about, okay, much of what happened with MACRA was positive. What have we learned about its implementation that should be revisited? That can be a very bipartisan conversation and has to be. Then I would also say one thing for us to keep an eye open for is work on access to new technologies. CMS has talked about proposing a new rule called TCET, which is intended to provide streamlined access to coverage for new devices once the FDA approves them. How does that move forward in the regulatory process, and is there need for any kind of legislative cleanup or support there? And then I would also say one thing that we should all be watching out for is I do think very early in the next Congress, we'll have important new data points in the Alzheimer's space with new therapeutics. Acknowledging what's been publicly discussed in the market, there have been products that have had readouts showing that the next generation of Alzheimer's medications is, at least according to the top line readouts, showing some encouraging efficacy. If that happens and we get to a product approval, CMS has created a regulatory construct that has constrained access through what they did last year around Aduhelm. So how that all plays out when we get a new product, and if that product is meaningful, that gives us all goosebumps, right? None of us could want anything more than to have an effective Alzheimer's med available to patients and the people who love them. If that happens, the system's going to have to do some scrambling to make sure the people who need to have access to that medicine have access to that medicine, that the price point is one that makes it truly accessible, and that the system is ready to absorb all of what that means. So, I don't think that's on anybody's proactive, so what are we going to do in 2023 agenda? But it's one of those life happens moments that we'll have to scramble quickly to make sure that everybody does the right thing.
So Chris, let me turn to you. So, Jennifer mentioned the Inflation Reduction Act and the provision giving requiring the government to negotiate the prices of some drugs in Medicare, and Republicans, pushing back on that provision, but probably not successfully, at least in the next 2 years. That is certainly on the administration's plate in terms of implementing that provision. The administration also has lots of authority to implement executive orders and regulations and guidance and approve and deny state waivers and implement pilot projects. What do you see the administration trying to do over the next couple of years without Congress using its executive authority?
Every time there is a polarized government and there's a perception of some stagnation in the Congress, the executive branch, whether the Republicans or Democrats, utilize its authority to pursue and promote its own agenda. That will certainly be the case in the Biden administration. First and foremost, as you've mentioned, though, they have to interpret and implement a lot of legislation. All the agencies do, and many within, certainly significantly within the IRA, the significant Medicare changes and benefit and design and restructuring, the extension of the ACA marketplace premium tax policies. And then, of course, we have preparing for potentially the elimination of or the sunsetting of the public health emergency. I know you want to talk about that separately, but all these things are really on the plate of the executive branch, regardless of what the Congress does. And as they're doing that, there'll probably be oversight, as Jennifer says, of how they do implement this legislation. On the negotiation policy, I will be surprised if the Republicans spend a lot of time on that over the next 2 years. I'm not sure they will, but I think you're going to see a lot of this happening more by the pharmaceutical industry, through the courts, and a lot of other things. So not only are we talking about executive branch, but we're going to also talk about judiciary. So I see this administration being very proactive. That means, but interest is already doing some work on providing care with dementia, and I think that's and particularly in Alzheimer's disease, and so that could be actually a collaboration of the congressional branch and interests and what CMMI is doing on delivery side and delivery reforms. So I wanted to mention these things because, generally first order policies, yes, Republicans and Democrats disagree on, as Jen says, usually it has to do with cost and coverage. Beneath that, when we're talking about just delivery reform, access to programs that are already in existence, more efficient execution, I think there can be a lot of agreement. And the last thing I just wanted to say is my hope is that there also are other areas of mutual agreement. There's bipartisan interest in coverage for post-incarceration populations and the Medicaid program. There's real interest in postpartum care, bipartisan, in the aftermath of the abortion controversy, I could see Republicans wanting to collaborate with Democrats. So I want to see the possibility for progress here. It's not going to be easy. It's not going to be comprehensive. But there will be developments of progress. And I think if Republican, I think it's in the interest of Republicans, frankly, to show a semi-proactive agenda. And certainly Democrats are already always ready to engage.
So Jennifer, I think it's safe to say there is going to be no agreement between Democrats and Republicans right now on abortion rights or restrictions. But Chris mentioned, for example, extending Medicaid during the postpartum period. Do you agree that that's an issue where there could be some bipartisan action?
Absolutely. And I think there was bipartisan interest even in this Congress in the pre-Dobbs era. And the Dobbs decision certainly supercharges the need for Republicans to be consistent with the results of their rhetoric on the abortion front. So I think that's a great example. And the people who will be most involved in that conversation in a new Congress from the Republican perspective, Kathy McMorris Rodgers, Brett Guthrie, Senator Crapo, these are thoughtful policymakers who come to Medicaid conversations with a desire to be constructive and find solutions. I would say that there is a dynamic in the Republican Party that makes Medicaid a little bit difficult right now as the party thinks through how to ensure Medicaid conversations don't spill in an unintended way into an abortion discussion. And there are people within the Republican Party who are very focused on any Medicaid money going into states could displace existing state dollars, which could then be used to finance their own support for choice-related issues. And I know that sounded convoluted as I explained it, because it is convoluted inherently, but there will be a sensitivity that Republicans are gonna have to navigate as we think through what do Hyde-like parameters look like in a post-Dobbs environment?
Hyde being the federal provision that restricts any funding for federal funding going to abortion services. So Jennifer, let me stick with you. So we talked about Medicaid, which leads to a discussion of entitlements more generally. There were some reports of some Republicans wanting to use raising the debt ceiling as leverage to try to get some changes, spending reductions in entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare. How do you see that playing out?
I think you described it well. I do think when the debt ceiling conversation comes to fruition, as it will certainly next year, I do think Republicans find it important that that conversation not take place in a vacuum. And certainly we would anticipate, the precedent was set under President Obama to not want any strings attached to debt ceiling discussions. But I do think Republicans believe it's a good time to see if you can renegotiate agreement around spending caps to try to constrain and give everybody a shared commitment to staying within global totals. So I do think there will be a desire to have that conversation happen. And I think at the same time, we should just acknowledge that the sequester has become kind of this go-to evergreening pay for in the healthcare context that, we now have this 2% across the board Medicare sequester, as far as the eye can see. Every time another 6 months opens up in the 10-year budget window, it becomes a go-to pay for taking care of healthcare needs in the system. So as it stands, we have this 2% across the board Medicare cut for the next decade. We also have looming this potential 4% PAYGO sequester that could be realized beginning on January 1, unless Congress works together to wipe the scorecard clean. I do think there's an expectation that that does happen. But all of those things together do kind of contribute to this environment in which a conversation about shared understanding of spending and what the dials are that are available to members, what that looks like, and a desire for that to be maybe a more thoughtful conversation than just a continuation of the sequester.
So these are, you're referring to automatic spending cuts, including provider rates under Medicare triggered by budget PAYGO rules. So Chris, there will be this lame duck, so-called lame duck session with the current Congress, not the new Congress, that we've been talking about that will play out over the coming weeks. Congress has to pass a budget or the government shuts down. But there may be these other health issues that they will take up. What do you see is likely in play during this lame duck session?
Well, first, I just have to comment on the debt limit policy just to say that it would be totally and fiscally reckless and irresponsible to tie any of that policy to a required intervention in some of these other areas. It's bad government, it's bad policy, it's bad economics, it's bad fiscal policy, and Democrats will strongly oppose. So I'll just say that on the record. And secondly, I just say that I noted that even within the Senate Republican leadership, there was a major disagreement about whether or not they should take on some of these issues, such as automatic sunsetting of programs and entitlement programs, et cetera. So there's even significant differences within the Republican Party, which I hope leads to some thoughtful resolution of that approach. So I just wanna put that on the record here. Secondly, I will say, generally when Republicans really engage in these policies, they run away from Medicare and Social Security, but they don't always run away from Medicaid significant cuts. And I think that those are always particularly vulnerable. And I always want to talk about how the most vulnerable populations are the most vulnerable here. So in terms of the lame duck question, I'm sorry, I didn't answer your question, Larry, is that maybe because of the concerns about next year and the debt limit, there'll be some interest in looking at alternative approaches to raising the debt limit, even in the lame duck session. That's a possibility. It won't be well received by Republicans, most likely, but I want you to know, I think people will be have noticed that and may want to look at that. Secondly, though, I generally look at lame ducks, as I always have, three filters. Four filters. The first one is, they never produce as much as people want them to or expect they will or maybe they should. Second, they do the things they absolutely must do. And last, third, there's some sort of bipartisan consensus for some legacy gift to some member of Congress. Or lastly, if the incoming Republican majority concludes it's in their interest to get some things taken care of in this session rather than next session. Where I see some of that fitting in that criteria is some of the emergency spending programs for Puerto Rico and Florida, but also even some of the Puerto Rico Medicaid policy that it's a now here disaster. And I think two, there's a lot of Republicans who'd like to address some of these issues. Secondly, I'm holding out hope for something even like postpartum, because there's bipartisan and it would immediately address some of the post-election issues on abortion. I think that there's some other targeted policy areas that are viable in the Medicaid program. Certainly in Medicare, there's gonna be a big push by providers to avoid the sequester cuts that Jennifer mentioned and the PAYGO cuts in particular. Physician hospital labs are areas that I would look to in particular, but I would not look towards comprehensive fixes. I would look towards like 1 year fixes, set up the conversation Jennifer says needs to happen in the next Congress for broader reforms.
So we have a bunch of questions from the audience that I want to turn to. And there were several questions around, we've been talking a lot about Congress and the Biden administration. But there were some very consequential results in the election at the state level. And abortion was an issue in a number of states. Medicaid expansion was an issue. In fact, Medicaid expansion passed in South Dakota as a voter referendum. I want to give you an opportunity to talk about what issues you see playing out in the states. And Jennifer, let me start with you, and particularly with abortion. Do you see continued movement in red states towards abortion restrictions or anything in the results that might change that?
You know, this is one of those conversations for a Republican woman that is always really tough to navigate. I would say that I do think there are many lessons to be learned that we saw states step back from the brink of the most aggressive interventions. And I do hope that's a lesson that the party takes seriously. And I think there are quiet conversations about whether the party at a national level should be paying careful attention to what happened, for instance, in a state like Kansas. And I think the fact that we have a divided Congress with a Democratic president certainly will affect how Republicans think about this at a national level, but I would be surprised if we don't see House Republicans, continue to be leaning in with aggressive positioning on abortion, while there are many people behind the scenes thinking that the most aggressive ban, regardless of exceptions, from the moment of conception, does not appear to be consistent with what. If we look objectively at what voters are saying to us, that's not what voters are saying to us. But again, I would not expect that to translate into an immediate and dramatic pivot in terms of party positioning.
And Chris, how about in bluer states? For example, on healthcare costs, there's likely not going to be continued movement at the federal level, at least through Congress. What might states do?
Well, first of all, of course, as you saw, some of the blue states wanted to absolutely double down on abortion rights within their states too, of course. And then I think really the as long as Republicans overreach in that area, Democrats will probably take advantage of that in a political spin. And I'm going to just say that. I think it's one thing Republicans, I think, should learn is taking away whether that or even elect is not. So we'll see where that lands. Sorry, editorial comment, Jack. So on the Democratic side, I do think let's help. Simplify and to address some of the different ways to constrain costs, even on Medicaid program into private sector and looking at some of the cost drivers in the states. I think in complexity for this Democrats who run the exchanges, you're gonna see some efforts to simplify and consolidate and be more aggressive on the marketplace at both constraining costs and providing information to enrollees to help them make better and informed and simpler decisions about the best options for themselves. And so I see, real innovations on those levels. Some of those, by the way, some of the cost driver related issues can be bipartisan at the state level. There is some interest in doing that even at the state level, or to work with the federal government to provide for more flexibility to access information about pricing practices. So those are areas where I see possibilities. Of course, in those states that haven't expanded Medicaid, there will be a lot of efforts, particularly in the purplish states, to continue to try to get states to expand coverage. Unfortunately, we lost, I think, our last best chance, maybe with the conclusion of this Congress, if we don't do it now, on finding alternative ways to getting people covered in the so-called coverage gap policies with the marketplace. I thought that was a very thoughtful set of policies. Going to be very challenging to see get done. And so I think we're going back to, you know, referendums and advocacy within the state levels. And the last point is, unfortunately, though, there are a lot of states who probably do not see it in their interest or have the legislative makeup to make a lot of progress in those spaces. So I'll stop with that.
So Jennifer, we, Chris mentioned Medicaid expansion, and we had a question about, you know, what these election results might mean for prospects for further Medicaid expansion in the states. You know, it's been this kind of steady creep in terms of states newly expanding Medicaid. Do you see anything changing at the state level based on these election results?
I do think there is an increasing awareness that, especially as the issue becomes perhaps a little bit less politicized with the greater separation with ACA, that states are leaving money on the table and their access is suffering. So I do think, you know, around the margins, it becomes an easier conversation to have. And the fact that these states are continuing to have ballot initiatives that kind of force the decision makes those states who have not yet done so also more reflective. So I wouldn't want to be naive or Pollyanna-ish, but I think it's a more of a reasonable topic to discuss today than it was 5 years ago. And you know, that's moving in an encouraging direction. I should also mention, was kicking myself for having forgotten to do so, that in the Medicaid space, one of the things that Kathy McMorris Rodgers would very much like to undertake in a new Congress when she's holding a gavel is spending time on the Medicaid disability side. And I think she will find willing partners in the majority and in her Senate counterparts to take a hard look at how Medicaid serves individuals living with disabilities and thinks about whether there are opportunities for improvement there, including around autonomy and decision-making, money follows the person kind of stuff. And that might, I wouldn't call that a Medicaid expansion in the sense that I think you mean it, but it would be a really nice opportunity to make some meaningful improvements in the program that could have the effect of improving access at the same time.
So we haven't talked too much about COVID. We did have a question about COVID funding.
I just wanted to say one quick thing about the disability thing, just while we are is I do that. That is another area where Democrats and Republicans have worked together in the past, and it's specifically in preserving access to Medicaid for people to go to work. And that's something that is very aligned with Republican ideology and Democrats' interests. And so I think you're gonna see some work being done in different world bipartisan policy center and others in that space that in which, you know, you could see some progress. And again, we wanna raise some flags of progress as we're talking a lot about polarization and stagnation. Now
I can talk about COVID. So we did have a question about COVID funding, which potentially relates to the lame duck session we were discussing earlier. The administration has put a funding request, a further revised funding request on the table. The amount keeps getting smaller. Start with you, Chris. What do you think the prospects are for increased COVID funding during this lame duck session?
Well, the administration will try, and Jennifer will say that we will fail, but I think so. I think the real issue has been, I'm going to just play bipartisan analyst here, is when you have complete exhaustion with COVID with public, number one, and number two, people are ignoring almost all guidance. Three, president has indicated that we may be beyond COVID. Four, there was a lot of money on the table that a lot of Republicans think haven't been spent yet. And five, the dynamic in a lame duck session is, as I said, unless it absolutely has to happen, and there's bipartisan consensus, it's very hard seeing it happening. But that would be my unfortunate, even though I believe the resources are necessary, and we may rue the day that we did not allocate resources for this, and I'm going to say that for the record now, but it doesn't look very good looking at the Congress.
So Jennifer, I want to give you an opportunity to revise the words that Chris put in your mouth.
Perfect. No, I agree with that completely. And I would also associate myself with the, you know, the reservation. I do think it would make sense for us to make sure that we are reserving the right to buy the next generation of monoclonal antibodies that are targeted to new variants, that we are continuing to research the need to evolve the vaccines as the variants mutate. And to ensure that we have the resources to facilitate access to those vaccines when they become available. So I, as Jennifer, would love to know that HHS has what they need to have to stay as much ahead of this as our science will allow us to be, but the political realities do appear to be different.
Yeah, and as the regular viewers of Health Wonk Shop know, we spent the last session talking about the coming commercialization of the COVID response. So certainly go look up that recorded episode. So a number of questions about Medicare, looming Medicare solvency or insolvency, I should say, Medicare Advantage, and whether there is any potential bipartisan movement towards tightening oversight of risk adjustment in Medicare Advantage or marketing or prior authorization. Chris, does this feel like an issue that lends itself to bipartisan action?
The Republican Party embraces the MA program almost as much as the Democrats embrace the ACA marketplace. And sometimes appropriate scrutiny and oversight over both get lost along the way. I think that I'm trying to be fair and balanced in my response here, but I'd say that there's no question that all independent entities who have been analyzing MA payments and practices would suggest that we are overpaying and there are abuses in coding and in underwriting and marketing. There will be oversight, there will be accountability, but I have a feeling that will be more done by the executive branch than the Congress. The Congress will tend to more likely moderate the executive branch, and the executive branch, frankly, has been criticized for not doing enough in this space yet. So I see that moving and changing over time. So as a general rule, though, I do think there will be a level of greater accountability. And I think part of the compromises with the Congress and the executive branch with the MA programs will be try to find the right balance between that accountability notion and a better ROI on our investment with the pressure that these enormous plans now face or now have, the leverage they have by covering approximately 50% of the Medicare beneficiary population in all sorts of places all throughout the country. Lastly, I'm just going to say on Medicare solvency overall, there was a effective extension of solvency. I think it's 28, I think, or so, something in those years or so. Generally, Congress waits until they have to act, and usually it's not 2 years before a presidential election. So Larry, the politics of that's going to be very tough to see major action. I could see a lot of work being done in policy areas to lay the predicate for some of those efforts. And frankly, we have to see in this next actuary report whether we see significant diminutions of the solvency of the program. We may see revenue declines and we may see significant healthcare expenditure increases because of inflation. We don't know, but that might alter the perception of the need to act quickly. But I think in order to do this, if we're really going to make progress, it's going to have to be bipartisan. And I think we have a ways to go to get there.
So Jennifer, on Medicare Advantage, I mean, Republicans led the creation of Medicare Advantage. It has been, you know, incredibly successful in terms of enrollment. As Chris said, you know, we're at virtually half of Medicare beneficiaries enrolled in a Medicare Advantage plan. Do you think there's an interest or appetite in sort of heightening oversight of the program or making any changes at this point?
So I think that conversation is going to be kickstarted by a regulatory action that we expect to come from CMS by February 1. And with apologies, and I promise I won't descend too much into geek speak here, but the RADV rule, which looks at coding intensity, has to be finalized by February 1st. It was due to be done this fall, but CMS gave itself an extension through OMB. And I mention that only because it will kind of call the question about whether the agency is going to take a tough line as it relates to coding intensity, which could be applied retroactively and could use extrapolation going back for a decade plus. So depending on what CMS comes out with, we could quickly find ourselves in a conversation in which all of these things are very much front and center. And there probably is a middle ground between retroactive extrapolation going back to 2011 and doing nothing. And that could be clarifying expectations with regard to coding intensity prospectively. So I think, yes, Republicans will find themselves in this conversation, whether they want to be or not, because we're all likely to have to respond to what CMS puts out.
So we're unfortunately coming to the end of our time and want to go from very wonky Medicare Advantage to bigger picture. And just as a final question, I want to ask each of you what you think is one surprise that may be coming over the next 2 years in health policy. Chris, I'll start with you.
Well, I would say surprise will be that anything gets done in this very polarized world. And I think some things will get done. I can see on mental health for children, integrated care, some, you know, we have a real crisis going on here. And it affects all sides of the political spectrum. And there's a real interest in pursuing these things. I apply that to some of those other issue areas that I mentioned. And I think the surprise is that there will be some progress, however limited. But then we will leave the big debates for coverage, access, real cost containment for the presidential election and beyond.
Jennifer?
Yeah, I'm going to try to be optimistic here. And I'm going to say that I would love for the surprise to be, we do start to see a couple of the pipeline products for Alzheimer's show that they really do make a meaningful difference. And we will see, you know, the happiest kind of accommodation come from the delivery system as we think about how do we accommodate effective meds? How do we have a broader conversation about caregiver support? Are there ways to leverage a combination of caregiver support and new medicines to delay access to institutionalization, to reduce ER visits, and start to see meaningful improvements in quality of life for a population that really needs a break. So how's that for my positive spin?
Well, great to end on optimistic notes. We'll come back to you in a couple of years and see how it all turned out. Thanks to both.
There's Kool-Aid here, Larry. There's Kool-Aid here for you.
Yes, the Kool-Aid. Well, thanks to both of you for a great discussion. Thanks to the audience for terrific questions and for joining us. And watch out for a recorded version of this and for the next episode of the Health Monk Shop.